Welcome to today's program. My name is Jim Armitage, and I'm from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And today I'm joined by Dr. Reed Merriman from the Dana-Farber Center in Boston. These are our disclosures. Today's presentation will discuss recent evidence and publications on emerging therapies for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma. Dr. Merriman will also describe implications for current or future practice of new clinical data in these same clinical situations. We will conclude with a brief discussion on how he and I treat these patients, and we'll have a little bit of dialogue. But now, it's my pleasure to turn the presentation over to Dr. Merriman.
I'm really excited to be here today to talk to you about follicular lymphoma management for relapsed and refractory patients. So as you all know, follicular lymphoma is the most common indolent non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Standard first and second line treatment options include chemoimmunotherapy, rituximab alone for select patients, and lenalidomide and rituximab is a common second line therapy used. While these treatments are not curative, most patients have excellent outcomes. On the right, you can see progression-free survival for patients treated with either rituximab or obinutuzumab-based chemoimmunotherapy in the Gallium study. And fortunately, there are multiple novel agents that are being tested or have been approved for treatment of third line and later therapy. So I want to focus on four different classes of drugs for today's talk. The first is PI3 kinase inhibitors. There have been significant changes in approvals in this area over the last year or so. The second is tazemetostat, which is an oral EZH2 inhibitor. The third class of drugs is bispecific antibodies that target CD3 and CD20. None of these drugs have been approved yet, but we expect approval soon. And the last class of drugs is CAR T-cell therapy. There are two CAR T-cell products that are currently approved for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma. So the first class of drugs is PI3 kinase inhibitors. So PI3 kinase, the PI3 kinase pathway is an important signaling pathway for B-cell lymphomas that's essential for proliferation and survival. And there are different isoforms of PI3 kinase that can be targeted, and they're expressed differently. So the alpha and beta subunits are expressed widely on both hematopoietic and non-hematopoietic tissues, whereas delta and gamma tend to be preferentially expressed on hematopoietic cells. Here you can see some important differences for these six drugs. So copanlisib is unique in two ways. First, it's the only IV drug among these six, and then second, it's a pan-PI3 kinase inhibitor. The other drugs listed here are orally administered, and they have specificity for the delta isoform, with duvelisib being somewhat unique in that it also has some specificity for the gamma isoform. So here I'm highlighting some important results from the phase 2 studies for these drugs among patients treated with follicular lymphoma. So you can see here that objective response rates range from about 40% up to 75%. There's pretty significant differences in the rate of complete responses, ranging from 1% up to 35%. And then the progression-free survival for most of these drugs is around 1 year. So you can see that the discontinuation rate is fairly high, up to 30% for these drugs. And that's been a significant concern, and I think one of the reasons that these are not used more widely in practice. So as of about a year ago, there were four of these drugs that were available clinically, but a few of them have been pulled off the market just in the last year. So idelalisib, duvelisib, and umbralisib are no longer available, and parsaclisib, the company has announced that they're no longer developing this drug for follicular lymphoma. So currently there's only one PI3 kinase that's clinically available, which is copanlisib, and the second, zandalisib, is still in clinical development. So I mentioned that toxicity is a concern for these drugs, and the toxicity that we see is dependent quite a bit on the different subunits that are targeted. So if alpha and beta are targeted, as in copanlisib, we see pretty significant rates of high-grade hyperglycemia and hypertension, whereas for all the drugs, delta is targeted, we see cytopenias, and then more concerningly, there is we can see severe diarrhea, colitis, hepatitis, transaminitis, and less commonly pneumonitis. So these toxicities have been a barrier for uptake of these drugs, and different companies have explored strategies to try to mitigate toxicity, for example, using a less potent delta inhibitor, as in the case of umbralisib, using intermittent dosing, which has been used by a few different PI3 kinase inhibitors, and then trying lower dosing as well. So I wanted to focus a little bit on copanlisib, which I mentioned is the only PI3 kinase inhibitor that's currently approved. So Kronos-3 was a phase 3 trial comparing rituximab plus copanlisib to rituximab and placebo. This trial enrolled patients with indolent non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Follicular lymphoma was the most common subtype, but it also enrolled other indolent NHL subtypes as well. Patients had relapsed after at least one prior line of rituximab-containing chemotherapy, and they excluded patients with poorly controlled diabetes. I'll point out that copanlisib is administered IV, and there's pretty frequent administrations, as you can see here. The primary endpoint for this trial was progression-free survival. So here I'm highlighting the important efficacy outcomes. You can see that the inclusion of copanlisib in treatment resulted in a higher objective response rate and complete response rate, and also improved progression-free survival in blue in the PFS curves here. But when they look specifically at the follicular lymphoma subtypes, the subgroup of patients with follicular lymphoma, the progression-free survival benefits seem to be less significant, only about a four-month difference in the two groups. So the next class of drugs I wanted to talk about are EZH2 inhibitors. So EZH2 is a histone methyltransferase that regulates germinal center transformation. EZH2 mutations can contribute to oncogenic transformation by locking cells in a germinal center state and preventing terminal differentiation. So in total, about a fifth of patients with follicular lymphoma have a gain of function mutation in EZH2, and tazemetostat was the first EZH2 inhibitor that was tested widely in follicular lymphoma. So I'm going to highlight the results from the phase 2 study, which looked at about 100 patients, either with EZH2 mutated follicular lymphoma or EZH2 wild type FL. You can see here that patients had received a median of two or three lines of prior treatment, and patients in the wild type group seemed to be higher risk based on the number of lines of prior treatment, based on the frequency of prior stem cell transplant, and also a higher frequency of progression of disease within 24 months of initial therapy, or POD24. So here are the response rates. So it looks like, at least based on response rates, that EZH2 mutation is a predictive biomarker. Higher objective response rates were seen for EZH2 mutated patients, 69% versus 35% for wild type patients. A low rate of complete responses was seen for patients regardless of EZH2 mutation status. But when you look at progression-free survival, the EZH2 mutation seemed to be maybe a less significant predictive biomarker. So about 14-month progression-free survival for mutated patients and 11 months for wild-type patients. So this progression-free survival is pretty similar to what was seen for PI3 kinase inhibitors. One of the things that sets this drug apart from PI3 kinase inhibitors is its tolerability. So there were very low rates of grade 3 or 4 side effects, and in general, this is a drug that is quite well tolerated and a good option for patients who have comorbidities and might not be good candidates for more intensive treatment options. And because this drug is well tolerated, it's an excellent possible combination partner. So the company is pursuing a phase 3 trial that's comparing R-squared plus placebo to tazemetostat plus R-squared. That trial is currently enrolling. Before they opened the phase 3 trial, they ran a small phase 1b trial looking at the safety and efficacy of that triad, tazemetostat, lenalidomide, and rituximab. So here you can see the baseline features of the 40 patients that were enrolled on that trial. Most patients had either one or two prior therapies. There were about 25% of patients who'd received only rituximab alone. But the preliminary results look encouraging, with an objective response rate of 91% and a complete response rate of 37%, which is a little bit higher than we would expect with R-squared alone. So the next class of drugs to highlight is CD3-CD20 bispecific antibodies. So bispecific antibodies target two different antigens, in this case CD3 on T cells and CD20 on follicular lymphoma cells. There has been some prior experience using bispecific antibodies in non-Hodgkin lymphoma using the CD3/CD19 bispecific blinatumomab, and this actually showed encouraging efficacy results, but its development was limited by side effects. So far, the data for CD3/CD20 bispecific antibodies looks very encouraging, with high response rates and lower rates of toxicity compared to CAR T cells, so lower rates of cytokine release syndrome and lower rates of neurotoxicity. On the right here, I'm listing the four bispecifics that are furthest along in clinical development. Two of the drugs, mosunetuzumab and epcoritamab, are being studied as subcutaneous administration. And glofitamab is unique in that it has bivalency for CD20. So first, a phase two trial of mosunetuzumab, which is the farthest along in terms of clinical development. So this trial enrolled patients with grade 1 to 3A follicular lymphoma who had received two or more prior lines of treatment. This drug was dosed using step-up dosing, which is a common strategy across all of the bispecifics. So you start with a very low dose that's increased over three doses. And the rationale for this is that there's some data suggesting that this can lower the rates of cytokine release syndrome with initial administration. In this trial was time-limited therapy with 8 cycles if patients achieved a CR, or 17 cycles if they were in a partial response or stable disease after 8 cycles of treatment. And importantly, this trial did not require mandatory hospitalization, which is fairly unique among mosunetuzumab, which seems to have a lower rate of cytokine release syndrome compared to some of the other bispecifics. The primary endpoint for this trial was complete response rate. So here's the waterfall plot. So you can see that nearly all patients had reduction in the size of their lymphoma. The objective response rate was 80% and the complete response rate was 60%. And prior chemo resistance or chemo refractoriness did not seem to be predictive of response. In this case, high response rates were seen for patients with POD24. So here's the progression-free survival and the duration of response, both of which look quite encouraging in a patient population that was heavily pretreated, although I'll point out that it doesn't seem like there is a curve, a tail on these curves. So here I'm highlighting the toxicity profile. So about 44% of patients had any grade CRS, and rates of high grade CRS were quite low at 2%, and neurotoxicity was rarely seen and tended to be low grade. So the next bispecific is glofitamab. Next I'm going to highlight results of a phase 2 study. This drug is also using step-up dosing to try to mitigate CRS, but it's also using an additional strategy, pre-treatment with the CD20 monoclonal antibody obinutuzumab, with the goal that that can either provide some debulking or remove any circulating B cells and further reduce the risk of CRS. So this trial also had very encouraging results, high objective response rate, high complete response rate, slightly higher than seen with mosunetuzumab. Follow-up was brief, so we don't have a good estimate for progression-free survival yet. It seems like the rate of CRS, particularly low-grade CRS, is higher for glofitamab than for some of the other bispecifics, but the rate of more severe CRS was also very low, and no neurotoxicity was seen in this trial. Epcoritamab is a subcutaneously administered bispecific, smaller body of evidence so far, but the early evidence also looks promising, high response rates and similar rates of CRS and neurotoxicity. Odronextamab was studied in 40 patients with follicular lymphoma. Again, very high response rates, objective response rate of 91%, complete response rate of 72%, and a similar progression-free survival compared to that seen for mosunetuzumab. Maybe slightly higher rates of cytokine release syndrome and higher grade CRS here, but again, low rates of neurotoxicity. So given the early success with bispecific monotherapy, there are a number of trials that are looking at bispecific-based combinations, so I wanted to highlight two of those. So this first trial is a combination of mosunetuzumab and lenalidomide. Patients are treated for 12 cycles, or about a year, with this combination. Again, a step-up dosing was used initially with the bispecific. I'll point out that the final dose of the bispecific here, 30 milligrams, is lower than what was tested with mosunetuzumab monotherapy. This is a similar cohort of patients, people who were relapsed or refractory to at least one prior line of chemoimmunotherapy. And you can see that, again, there were very high response rates, an objective response rate of 90%, a complete response rate of 66%. With the lower dose of mosunetuzumab, it seemed like there were lower rates of any grade CRS, and no high-grade CRS was seen. Epcoritamab has also been studied in combination with lenalidomide plus rituximab, and among the 30 patients, the preliminary results look very encouraging, with an objective response rate of 100% and a CR rate of 93%, with similar rates of CRS and neurotoxicity. So I think these data are very exciting, but there are some important questions that still need to be answered. Is there a difference in efficacy across these different bispecifics? It seems like they're probably more similar than different, but there may be slight differences that emerge with longer follow-up. Are there differences in safety, perhaps higher rates of CRS for some of the bispecifics compared to others? And can these be safely administered in the outpatient setting and in community practices? And I think the answer to both of those questions is likely yes, but I think there's still a learning curve and we're still working on best practices to safely administer these drugs in different settings and ideally in the outpatient setting. And then given the very encouraging results, I think a key question is how do we optimally combine these treatments with other FL treatments that are effective. So there are many trials ongoing in the first and second line setting, and I think in 5 years, we may be seeing these drugs even earlier in the FL treatment paradigm. And then finally, to highlight CAR T-cells, which are probably the most active drugs for patients with relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma, there are two CAR T-cell products that are approved. The first approval came for axi-cel, and it was based on ZUMA-5, which was a phase 2 study that tested axi-cel among patients with relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma or marginal zone lymphoma that had relapsed after at least two prior lines of treatment. Patients received standard cyclophosphamide and fludarabine lymphodepletion followed by axi-cel. The primary endpoint in this study was objective response rate. So here in the middle, you can see response rates for patients with follicular lymphoma, which were the largest group in the study. The objective response rate was 94%. The complete response rate was 79%, so very high response rates, higher than seen with marginal zone lymphoma patients in this study and quite a bit higher than seen for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Here's the progression-free survival for all patients. Patients with follicular lymphoma are in blue, so durable remissions, but again, unclear if there's a tail on this curve, unclear if some patients may be cured with CAR T-cell therapy in this setting. And here's data for the phase 2 study for tisa-cel, which is the second CAR T-cell product that's approved for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma patients. The objective response rate here was 86%, a complete response rate of 69%, and at 12 months, about two-thirds of patients were still alive and in remission. It looks like different subtypes of follicular lymphoma benefited, although there may be a trend that higher risk patients like POD24 patients or patients with an elevated LDH at study entry may have had lower rates of complete response, shown here in red. Again, encouraging response duration for these patients, although I think it's unclear if some patients may be cured with tisa-cel as well. And follow-up here is shorter than we had with axi-cel. And then to compare safety, there are important differences in safety between these two products, similar to differences that were seen in other in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So axi-cel is associated with a higher rate of any grade CRS and higher rates of severe CRS, and a similar pattern is seen for neurotoxicity. So it may be that the slightly higher efficacy response rates and more durable remissions likely come at the cost of increased toxicity. So we're in a fortunate place for patients with relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma. We have a number of good treatment options. PI3 kinase inhibitors, I think there are still concerns about toxicity and we have fewer options available, but there still is a place, I think, for copanlisib for carefully selected patients who maybe don't mind frequent infusions. Tazemetostat is a very well-tolerated option That's a good option for patients who have comorbidities and aren't good candidates for more intensive therapies. CD3, CD20 bispecific antibodies are not yet approved, but I think we'll see our first approval soon. And I think these drugs are going to be an important part of our treatment armamentarium for this disease. And then, of course, CD19 CAR T-cell therapy is an extremely active disease, but one that requires, in most cases, hospitalization and does have a higher risk of side effects. So there are key differences in safety, ease of administration, and efficacy, as I pointed out. And really, the sequencing of these agents depends on the individual patient, on the aggressiveness of their follicular lymphoma, on their comorbidities, on their wishes. And to emphasize once again, this is a shifting landscape, and I think the treatment landscape will look quite a bit different in the years to come, as there are numerous trials in earlier lines of therapy that could change our current standard approach.
Reed, thank you for that very nice and thorough and very clear presentation on a complicated, increasingly complicated clinical situation, a disease where we're getting too many treatments, where we have all these things we can do and it's hard to choose. And I'll ask you about that in a minute. But what I'd like to do to spend the next few minutes is to go back and forth with you. I'll try to be asking the questions that I can imagine our viewers who get to view this might want to be able to ask of you, because they've got a chance here to find this international expert in this disease. So I'm going to ask you the questions that I think the clinicians might want to know. And a couple of these aren't specifically about therapy, but just how you practice. One, when you have a patient that's referred to you or one of your patients who has a recurrent relapsed follicular lymphoma, when do you do a biopsy? I assume you'd be sometimes you want to rule out diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. What are your rules for a biopsy before you treat?
That's a great question. It's a really important question. So I think I try to biopsy as much as possible. I try to basically in every circumstance do a biopsy. Because I think, we do see fairly high rates of transformation. The lifetime risk is probably on the order of 20 to 30%, and it's higher in patients with higher risk disease, for example, POD24 patients. So I will try to biopsy after each line of therapy, and particularly if patients have a high SUV over 10 or 15 on a restaging PET scan, I'll definitely try to biopsy those patients, because many of our traditional follicular lymphoma treatments are not effective or not as effective for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So we really want to know if a patient is transformed before we subject them to a new treatment.
Anytime you're treating somebody with follicular lymphoma, watch and wait after Saul Rosenberg showed that it can be a very useful clinical approach sometimes. You always think about that. And I would like to know, I'm sure all of us would like to know, if you have rules where you would always observe without therapy or you would never observe without therapy. What are the rules you follow?
That's a good question. It's hard to say always. I feel like there are almost always exceptions. But
yes, I often tell patients, physicians use the words always and never very often. You probably should get rid of them. Medicine's not like that. But anyway, I'm sorry.
I agree. So I think, patients with a small tumor burden who are asymptomatic, I think you have to think of a good reason to treat those patients. So I try to encourage watchful waiting for those patients, even if patients are initially reluctant, which many patients are, especially at first diagnosis. And then, obviously, anytime a patient is symptomatic, I will start treatment. If patients have bulky disease or disease that really puts at risk important organs. So, patients who have lymphadenopathy that's pushing on liver or kidneys, for example, I encourage those patients to start treatment even if they don't have symptoms at that time.
Thank you. Okay, now there are a number of old treatments here. And I'm going to ask you about a few of them and where you think about them or you just don't ever think about them anymore at all. How about radioantibodies?
To be honest, radioantibodies, I think, came along before the data for it came along before I started treating patients with lymphoma. I think, you know, the efficacy in those trials looks really encouraging, but there is a risk of MDS. So at our center, I think we've really stopped using them. This one setting where we were still using them some was as kind of bridging therapy to allotransplant, where you worry a little bit less about the long-term risk of MDS. But I think, you know, we're fortunate to have, as you said at the beginning, almost too many options for follicular lymphoma. So I think things like radio immunotherapy, or to some degree autologous stem cell transplant, which has higher risk of long-term side effects, as we get better and better options, we're using those treatments less frequently.
And us, by the way. And radioantibodies are even hard, radio immunotherapy is hard to be able to get to treat a patient with. But I have to say, both I have a patient treated many, many years ago with a radioantibody who got a remission and has never relapsed decades later. And with autologous transplants, your institution and the group in London and we have all reported fairly large series where people stay well for a really long time. My longest patient now is about 38 years. So I'm not sure ignoring those like we tend to do, especially the auto transplant, is the right thing, but it's become much, much less popular. Allotransplants. You implied that you still do those.
We do. I think allotransplant's actually a really important treatment, particularly for young patients with follicular lymphoma. So, you know, our data right now suggests an overall survival for FL that's probably close to or over 20 years. But for patients who are diagnosed in their 40s or 50s, you know, we'd like them to live longer than 20 years. So I think allotransplant's an important option for those patients. It can be curative. The rates of long-term survival after allo are really quite good for follicular lymphoma, better than for other lymphoma subtypes. It seems that the graft versus lymphoma effect is probably better for FL than for other lymphoma subtypes. So I have referred patients to allo when you're running out of treatment options with more conventional treatments.
And the last one of the old ones I'd like you to comment, I'm sure everybody would like to hear what you say, is when do you use traditional external beam radiotherapy?
Yeah, so I think that is the standard for patients with early stage follicular lymphoma at diagnosis, where the long-term data suggests that we can probably cure 40 or 50% of patients with radiation. And then in other settings, I use it for palliation. So if a patient has one lymph node that's causing issues, but otherwise their disease is well controlled and they're not having symptoms, I'll use oftentimes 2x2, two gray times two fractions to treat those symptoms and hopefully delay systemic therapy some amount of time.
Me too, and I'm shocked about how efficacious that can be. It seems like it's just a CT scan, but it has sometimes an amazingly good effect. All right, so before we quit, there really are a lot of choices, and you just reviewed for us the future, these new exciting therapies. Today, outside of a study, if you could get the drugs, which would you use in which situations? Which one of those do you favor of the new things you said? Which are you most excited by?
So I think, for our highest risk follicular lymphoma patients, where you're really worried about them, where their disease is behaving aggressively, where maybe you haven't been able to prove transformation, but clinically you have a suspicion for transformation, I think those are the patients where CAR T-cell really is the optimal treatment. I think there aren't a lot of patients with follicular lymphoma where you need CAR T-cell, at least where you need it right now. But those are the patients where I've been using CAR T-cell therapy. I think for other patients who maybe have a disease that's a little bit better behaved, I'm really excited about bispecific antibodies. I think they're really effective drugs. They're generally well tolerated, particularly after the first one or two cycles. Most of the CRS that we see is within that first cycle or two, and afterwards these tend to be quite well tolerated. And I think they're good combination partners. So I think going forward, we're going to be using these more frequently and probably earlier in treatment. I think tazemetostat is a good option, particularly for patients, old, frail patients who aren't good candidates for chemo or for CAR T-cell therapy, for example. So I think that's kind of how I think about these drugs that I mentioned today.
Reed, thank you. That was a both wonderful talk, and I'm sure everybody enjoyed the insights that you just provided about how to actually apply these approaches to these patients. Thank you very much.
Thank you.